Welcome to another talk on this lovely retreat in this beautiful place where everything is supplied, even the holy water. So for those who want to conserve water today, you don't need to have a shower, just go outside. Take your soap and just soap up outside. Then you'll be environmentally friendly. But as I said, today it's actually very nice to have it nice and cool, because usually the November retreats which we run are usually very, very hot. So this is nice and cool. And cool weather is really the best. I often used to say that when it's really wet and cold, there's nothing else to do except to meditate. You can't go for walks, you can't get out of this place. So that means the only thing you can do is to go inside. Because when the rain comes, it tends to bring you more inside yourself. Because you look outside, there's not much you can see. Everything is sort of suppressed. Everything is sort of dull. Because the light from the sun doesn't manage to get through to brighten up the leaves on the trees. So even the birds are quiet. So this is one of the best days you will have to get enlightened. So, how to get enlightened? And yesterday, at the question time, I did promise I will talk a little bit more on jhanas and why they're important to get enlightened. And even though some people are just think they're so far away from enlightened, I haven't been able to watch two breaths in a row all week. I haven't been able to be still. I've been all over the place. And now he talks about jhanas. Oh, this is really going to be a tough talk. No, don't think like that, because one day, when you least expect it, when you think you've got no hope, then it happens. So because most of you think you've got no hope all the time, you've got a very good chance. And that's what happens. Just sometimes just people press the letting go button, as I call it. They get into these deep, deep states of meditation. And one of those occasions, I don't want to scare you, but this is what happened to one of our members who was... used to come. I haven't actually seen him for a long time. I'd better not say what his name is. But he told me once that one Sunday afternoon, when he was at home, he decided to just do a little bit of meditation. So he went into his bedroom. He was only supposed to meditate for about 40 minutes, out the max. After about an hour and a half or two, his wife wondered where he was. So went into his room, and there she saw her husband sitting in meditation, perfectly still, too still. He wasn't even breathing. And she looked, she couldn't see any breath happening. So she thought, oh my goodness, my husband has died. So she called in Perth 000, the ambulance. Within 5 or 10 minutes, the ambulance came, screaming to the front of the door with the siren sounding. And the medics rushed into the bedroom, and they looked at him, they took his pulse. There was no pulse. They couldn't discern anything. So straight onto the stretcher, into the back of the ambulance, and on top speed, we're going through all the red lights, with the siren sounding, woo 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 woo. I can't do sound, but I'll try my best. Woo 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 woo. Right through the streets of Perth. Just a track. It's actually much better when you don't do it properly, because that people laugh, because it's silly. But anyway, by the time you get to Charles Garden Hospital, they rushed him into the emergency room, because he wasn't breathing, he wasn't, no pulse. And they put on the ECG, and to find if he had any heartbeat at all. There was no heartbeat. It was a flat line. Ding, 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 emergency. Doctor told me it doesn't go ding, 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 emergency. But you know, I've got to sort of make these stories interesting. Ding, 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 emerges a flat line. And then they put the EEG in to see if there's any brain activity. Ding, 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 emergency, another flat line. He was dead. He'd gone. And he was very, very lucky. He said the thing which saved him was that the doctor in the emergency room that day happened to be of Indian descent. His parents were Indian, were Hindus. And he remembered his parents telling him once that these yogis, you know, in the Himalayas, then get into such deep samadhi, deep state of stillness, they too can suspend all their life activities. He said he was in meditation. His life activities are stopped. Perhaps he's not really dead yet. He was very, very lucky he thought like that. If it was an Australian doctor, he'd have been sent straight down to the morgue. He was only in meditation. He was to come out later on. Imagine, you're down in the morgue, certified dead, and then suddenly you come out of your meditation. Wow, you kill all the morgue assistants. That must be a very scary, scary place to work, because you don't know if the person lying on the slab is really dead, or whether they're just in meditation. So they tried defibrillators on his body. You know, you've seen those things maybe on the TV. These electric pads they put on your chest, and you go boom, and your whole body sort of lifts a couple of centimetres off the ground. Boom. If any of you got sloth and torpor, maybe I'll try a few of those. That'll wake you up. They tried that many, many times, according to his wife. As for him, he was just having a wonderful time. Deep inside, blissed out, great time. He didn't know at all what was going on with his body, the defibrillators going on and people all messing around him. And many times they tried and nothing worked. No matter how many times he did that, nothing worked. Until he decided it was time to come out of his meditation. And he opened his eyes. And he leant up. Beep, beep, beep. All the machines were normal again. And the doctor couldn't believe it. The wife was so relieved. And as for him, he said, I was in my bedroom. What am I doing in here? How did I get here? Because he'd been deep inside, perfectly aware, but blissed out. And he said, the doctor gave him a big check-up. You know, obviously he'd been in that situation. Could find nothing at all wrong with him. Perfect health. So they let him go and he walked home with his wife. Didn't have to stay overnight in hospital. Perfectly okay. Nothing wrong. He said the only unpleasant part of that, the only part of that whole experience which he didn't like, was what his wife told him on the way home. Don't you ever do that again. Don't you ever, ever. He got a really bad scolding from his missus. Since I last saw him, I don't think he's ever done that again. Have you ever seen him? Well, I knew where he's gone. Because I haven't seen him for a long time. Maybe he just got into deep meditation. Actually, they did put him in the morgue. I don't know. He sort of disappeared. Anyway, that was a classic case of what happens to you when you get into deep, deep, deep meditation, like a jhana. You can't hear any sounds. You can't hear the sound of the ambulance. You can't feel these electric shocks in your body. You're not unconscious. You're perfectly aware in the sixth sense, the mind. Everything else has disappeared. There's two other stories of that. There's another person that some of you know. You'd be quite surprised that when he was very young, he had these very bad headaches. He was in the British Army. He had such bad headaches. The only way that he could deal with them was, he said, to go deep, deep, deep inside to where he couldn't feel the migraine. He said once he was on manoeuvres with the British Army in Germany many years ago, and he had one of these terrible migraines. And his group of soldiers, you know, he had a truck and a few soldiers in the back, they were told just to stop and have a cup of tea. So they all stopped, and he gave them okay to have a cup of tea. He didn't want a cup of tea. There was a barn in a farm close by. And you know, if you've got a migraine, sitting in a very dark place, it actually helps. So he went into the darkness of the barn, and he said, went deep inside himself. He didn't know meditation or Buddhism. He just went deep, deep inside where the migraine couldn't be felt. And what happened was that the guy with the radio was told, you know, get up, you've got to move. So they all got it in the truck. We're driving down some road in Germany. They thought, oh my goodness, we forgot our sergeant major. Or sergeant, he was an officer, that's what he was. We forgot him. So they all had to turn around again. And they found him in the in the barn, just perfectly still. They just lifted him up, dumped him in the back of the truck. Now, soldiers are not the most sensitive and delicate of human beings. So they must have actually dropped him in or something. But he didn't know a thing. When he came out of his sense of peace, he wasn't in the barn anymore, he was in the back of a truck. And he couldn't believe just how he got there. And he was perfectly alert all the time. But again, deep inside. Now he, because of the pain, figured out a way to get into those deep meditations. And the last story was a monk which I knew, and he was a very, very powerful monk. He was an Indonesian monk a long time ago. There are such things as psychic powers, but you know, monks don't usually show them. But this guy certainly had them. You can tell he's an incredibly strong character, strong mind, very kind. But he was a monk, and he told me that where he really started his meditation, before he was a monk, he was just, you know, an ordinary person, a Buddhist in Indonesia. And he decided just to go into the jungles, which were still many in Indonesia, just to go and be a hermit. So he went there, and he said he was meditating, sort of in the jungle. And I remember just what he told me. He said he saw this big star come towards him. And he merged into this star. He was there for days. So he merged in this deep meditation. And when he came out afterwards, and totally blissed out, he noticed the scenery around him had changed. No one had moved him. It was just that there were markings on the tree which indicated there had been a huge flood. You know, which happens in a monsoon season, maybe in a low ground in the jungle. He checked with the villagers, and yeah, he'd been underwater for many, many days. He'd been actually submerged. And he could see that, there was no doubt about that. So there he was meditating, this huge flood had come. And he hadn't worried at all. He'd been totally underwater for days. And it didn't matter, because in deep, deep meditation. So if it continues raining today, just get into deep meditation and you'll be safe. Now those are weird stories, but you know, those are from my own personal life, and they're true. Now these are actually things which happen. So this just gives you an idea what these jhana states are like. They're weird. They're deep, they're powerful, but they actually exist. So what happens is that you press that letting go button and you go very deep into meditation. It has to be through letting go. You try to get into those states, no way. Many times people get those states once and then they try again. Because they try again, it's impossible. You forget how they arose in the first place, through letting go, not through striving. That story that similarly I gave a day or two ago about the hedge maze. You have to go that one path, which is the letting go path. That leads to the center. All the other paths, you come across a brick wall sooner or later. Striving only gets you so far. You have to let go big time. Which is interesting. This is why Buddhism is not just talking about these deep meditations, but it also talks about non-self. Striving, that just makes a bigger self. Letting go is overcoming that sense of self. And it's also the way you get into these deep meditations, and because you know that's the way, that gives you the insight. Yeah, there is no self. If there was a self, you wouldn't be able to get into those deep meditations. You wouldn't be able to just disappear and let go. Because there is no self, that's why you can let go. So anyway, that is the path into these deep meditations. It's almost testing out the Buddha's teachings on anatta. That anatta is truthful because you can let go and disappear. If there was a self, it couldn't disappear. So this is what happens. You just really let go big time. And little by little, you've had moments of letting go. Yeah, you've had moments, you know, sitting here and just doing nothing. Basically wasting time, killing time, whatever it is, because you don't think anything's going to happen. Send another 10 minutes to lunch. No way I'm going to get anything. Now those are the brilliant times. Because there you're not trying, you're not hoping, no expectations. You are just cruising. You're taking your hands off the steering wheel of your life. You just release the pressure off the pedals which drive you. You just let go. And this is what happens, I've told you before. Just when you start to let go, time disappears. That's one of the first things. So some of you already, you've sat here and you've come out of meditation afterwards, you weren't asleep, you were perfectly aware, And you can't believe that an hour's gone past. That was only 10 minutes. Now the clock must be wrong. It's not wrong. You know, you've just gone beyond time. You've let that thing go. And just what a wonderful freedom that is, not to be worried about time. Just how much stress and tension that creates in your mind and your body. And then you simply let go of this inner speech. So you're not saying anything. It's important to let go of the inner speech, because the inner speech is almost like the means for controlling. You think, then you act. It's also like, again, that often quoted saying from the philosopher Descartes, you know, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. What happens if you don't think? So the Buddha would argue with Descartes, yeah, that's true. If you think, you are. If you don't think, you disappear. That's wonderful, because when you stop thinking, you vanish. That's one of the other reasons why you find it hard to think. Because you can't let go of your identity. You can't disappear. Or rather, you won't disappear. Because that's what happens when you stop thinking. You lose all your reference points to your world, to life. So all the bricks which make you, which build you up, all those are taken away. You're peaceful, you're still. Well, the nice thing with stillness, though, everybody experiences moments when they're not thinking. And they just feel so pleasant. And they've got the aura of sacredness about it. Which is why that many, many religious icons are places of silence. Why we build monasteries outside the city, because it's quite quiet. One of the best places to meditate are the caves, where there's no noise at all. Where in Australia you can go out into the bush, which is also incredibly peaceful. And there is something which actually moves every individual, even if they're just, you know, the least spiritual you could possibly imagine. They go out into the bush and it's so quiet, it hits them very hard. The meditation hall over at Bodhinyana Monastery has got great energy. So many of you have already gone walking over there to meditate over there in the afternoon. You're most welcome to it. It's really got good energy over there. But I will never forget that story when we had a builder doing our concrete water tanks. A very nice guy, but a very rough Australian. You know, every other word was an F word. He's a nice guy, but that's just how he's brought up. And so he was, whenever I'd check up on how his work was doing, you know, he'd love to have a chat. And talking to so much sort of silly stuff, and you know, but you know, I wanted him to do a good job, so I was always saying, oh yeah, that's very interesting. You have to be a bit of a diplomat if you're an abbot and just say nice things to people, otherwise you get in big trouble. But anyway, at the end of his job, you know, just when he's finished, before he went home, he said to me, would you mind if I look in your church, Brahm? He met in the meditation hall, he called it a church. I said, of course, come along. And so he was talking just so fast until, you know, he got to the door and he saw the sign, had to take off his shoes. He said, do you have to take off my boots? And I had his big work boots. He said, no, just, you know, stand on the corner and just put your head inside. And as soon as he put his head inside that hall, he went dead quiet. It was such a wonderful experience, you know, for me, just being with him. Because you knew that something had hit him very deeply. And he was silent there, just, you know, just with his head inside the room for about 2 minutes. And then he'd put his head out again and say, wow, this is good, isn't it, Brahm? And he just is just an ordinary person. He was touched by the silence in that place. And even though he, you know, probably never had a spiritual bone inside his body, nevertheless, he recognized, well, he did, you know, but he didn't understand that he did. He recognized that was very good, a place of silence. Which is why that when you do press that letting go button, there's something inside of you, if you haven't heard any talk about Buddhism or any idea of meditation whatsoever, you recognize that as something very precious. You know, what really is spiritual, whatever that word really means, but silence certainly is. And so it actually draws you in. Something has disappeared. You've let go. And very often, you know, from that silence, just we get so joyful. You know, at last it sense you're free. You know, we all look for freedom. And I've often mentioned, you know, the two types of freedom in this world, because Sometimes about that question last night, which said about, you know, why do you monks keep all these silly rules? Why do you keep any rules at all? Don't all those rules just, you know, put you in a prison? I can't do this, I can't do that. What's wrong with having a sandwich in the afternoon? Why can't you monks have a glass of milk if you want it? It's not evil. Why can't you do this? Why can't you do that? We think like that when we're young, but then we remember that that's because we've been pursuing the freedom of desires all our life. The freedom to do what we want when we want it. The freedom to follow every desire, every want. And for many that's the goal in life, to become rich and powerful enough. If you want something, you can get it. And that's called the freedom of desires. But as a monk, you have all these, you can't do this and you can't do that. And people think that must be terrible. Why do you do things like that? Well, what's wrong with watching a movie? What's wrong with watching the TV? What's wrong with just having a relationship? What's wrong? Because as a monk, we follow the path of freedom from desires. So those desires are just not there. We just don't want anything. It's not that we want and we can't have. It's just we don't want in the first place. There's an incredible sense of peace. The driving force of life, craving, just doesn't arise. We just don't want. That's called letting go. That's why being a monk and being a nun, which celebrates not the freedom of desires, but the freedom from desires, it really enhances your ability to meditate, because you don't want things in the world. When you're meditating, you don't want things inside either. Instead of like trying to get something, we're trying to get the state of mind which doesn't want anything in the first place, which is just quite content just to be where it is with what it's got. Sure, I don't have many possessions, but I've got enough. It's good enough for me. I've got my robe. It's good enough. I've got my cave. It's good enough. I've got my bowl. It's good enough. I've got the food which I can eat. Good enough. So you get this wonderful freedom from desires. That gives you an incredible sense of peace, which is why you're a monk. Because you're following a different path, not the freedom of desires, but the freedom from desires. So when you do that, you realize that's letting go, that's a path of meditation. So when you sit down, in the world, I don't want money, I don't want sex, I don't want relationships, I don't want children, I don't want this. In meditation, I don't want jhanas, I don't want nimittas, I don't want enlightenment, I don't want fame, I don't want anything. And if you have that type of mind, that freedom from desires mind, you get so still and peaceful. Thoughts don't come. And this body, which is always asking you to do things, which is what the seat of many of your desires, to give me pleasure, eat the nice food, see the great movie, sort of have the great sex. All of that vanishes. And it's wonderful when things go. I've mentioned that this is the great vanishing act. In fact, I think Ajahn Bhamali has been editing some of the transcribed talks I've given to the monk, to the monks. It's being published now by Wisdom. It's the next book in the series of books I've written. And he's called it The Art of Disappearance. I was really quite pleased when he got that title, The Art of Disappearance. Because that gives another sort of angle on what this meditation is all about. Things disappear. Your past disappears, your future disappears, all your thoughts disappear. All your sense of identity disappears. And your body disappears. And when that goes, when it vanishes, that's called jhanas. You're sitting there blissed out. You can't hear. People ring the gongs. You just don't hear it. There's this one novice. This is a lovely story. It just shows anybody can get into these states. This was one of those, you know, little novices who became a monk. I think either because his parents had too many children, they couldn't look after them, or there was some problem in the family, or maybe he ran away. Maybe somebody died and his surviving parent married someone else, they didn't want him. The monasteries used to be just the social service department. you know, where unwanted children could, you know, find a home, get loved, and get food, get looked after. So everyone had a place to go. So, you know, he went to one of the monasteries, and he wasn't sort of one of these people who decided to become a novice because he was interested in religion. It was just nowhere else to go. You always get well fed. And most of those novices, you know, I remember quite a few of them, you know, they get looked after by the monks until about 14 or 15, and then they would leave. They were, you know, old enough to look after themselves, and they would sort of go to school and eventually get married. But, you know, there was a second home when they were growing up in the monastery. But this particular novice, one evening Ajahn Chah was given one of his talks. And I say this, you know, out of the deepest respect for one of the greatest masters, the wisest person I've ever known Ajahn Chah. And many of you have read some of his books and been inspired. But if you were there at the time listening to his talks, you, like me, would have gotten bored out of your skulls. He would go on for hours and hours and hours and hours. Rubbish. And I say that as, you know, as a devoted disciple. Every now and again he'd say something inspiring and meaningful. And it was worth waiting for. It was like, you know, in Kalgoorlie, digging gold out of the dirt. You get a tiny bit of gold in a huge heap of dirt. And that was like Ajahn Chah's talks. So what, you know, people have done for you, they've, you know, distilled all the best teachings, all the nice aphorisms. And that's what you read in the books. You get it so easy. You don't have to sort of, you know, bear with all this rubbish stuff, you know, to listen to it. You get it all, so, you know, the best condensed, like the best of Ajahn Chah, that's what you get. The worst no one actually listens to unless you were there at the time. So this was one of those talks that went on and on and on. And, you know, I don't think I was there at that time. But this little monk, this little novice, was getting really bored. It was going on to very late, 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night. This novice said, look, you know, I'm only coming here just, you know, to get looked after. I'm not really interested in this stuff. I don't want to become enlightened. I'm only a small novice. I need my rest. You know, maybe these big guys, they're tough, but I'm only about 11, 12, 13 years of age. I want to go to bed. You know, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? And that became like a mantra. You know when you get obsessed? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? When is he going to stop? And this mantra was obsessing him. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? And then insight happened. Even for a 12-year-old kid, he just turned it around. He said, when am I going to stop? And then he stopped. Just like that, just stop. And he got into this incredibly deep meditation. Because when he opened his eyes, it was dawn. All the monks had gone a long time ago. And he just remained sitting there. Again, blissed out, a happy little young man. First time he got a great deep meditation. He hadn't heard when the bell had gone. And before they'd leave, they'd bow and they'd sort of do the chanting and everything else. He hadn't heard nothing. He'd been perfectly still and peaceful. And he realized that he too had pressed that letting go button. He just stopped. So you can ask yourself, when later on you have the time to meditate, ask yourself, when am I going to stop? And see if you can stop. And you get into these deep meditations. So hear all that movement of the mind, going off onto the next thing, wanting things, all that agitation, the waves on the lake, you know, the wobble in the cup when you hold it. Everything gets perfectly still. There's stillness, not concentration. Stillness, peace. When things become still, things disappear. So all you're left with is just this mind. The sense of hearing, gone. Physical sensation, gone. They can tap you on the shoulder, put defibrillators on you, lift you up from one place and put you in a truck. You just don't know it. So look, you don't need to worry if you get into one of these deep states. If you have to fly back to Sydney or to London or to Brazil, don't worry about that. We'll just lift you up and put you on the plane. And you'll just come out of meditation halfway over Europe. Say, where am I? Where am I? You'll be fine. So you won't feel a thing except the bliss inside. So that's a sign of what the jhanas are. First of all, when people ask, you know, because you always want to know, you know, when these things happen, what they happen. Unfortunately, because monks like me start talking about them, you know, I was one of the first ones to go talking about these things, and I thought, why not? You know, this is what Buddhism is all about, let people know. But the downside of that is, as soon as you start talking about them, I want. In fact, these other people can get them. If a 10-year-old, 12-year-old novice can get them, why not me? Come on, I'm going to get jhanas. 3 days left. Jhanas, okay. What else? And that's why many people come to the retreat with me, because they want jhanas. Understandable, but look, the wanting doesn't work. So when I talk about jhanas, I make this important point. Don't want them. If you want them, no way are they going to happen. Create the stillness. Be still, 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 still. And the jhanas are like the byproduct of stillness, deep, deep stillness. So when they occur, you go into these great states of mind, and afterwards you come out. And because you want so much, you bend the truth and say your little state was a jhana when it wasn't. Be careful. So look, do a checklist. Be honest. Could you hear things? Could you feel your body? Were you thinking? Because if in that state you think, is this a jhana? No, it can't be. Because the mind is too still to think, to verbalize. It's only afterwards when you come out and think, wow, that was amazing, what was that? And sometimes it takes 2 or 3 or 4 of those experiences to actually get enough data through your memory to realize what these things are. The best way is to go through nimittas. Because if you go through nimittas, that's the well-worn path, which means that you know exactly where you are and what happened. Brilliant, brilliant lights show the mind's getting very strong and peaceful and happy, because everything else is fading away. So much brilliance that you can't feel anything or hear anything, totally absorbed and just drawn right inside. To go to those places, very, very peaceful. The different jhanas, one inside the other, but basically they're reasonably similar. The only difference is that not the intensity, but the quality of the happiness. But they're great states. This is what the Buddha said was the place where you can get the data for enlightenment. Not only are they incredibly happy, which is a nice thing to have a bit of bliss in your life, but also they just start to rock the way you think about life. They change your views. The very fact that such a thing could exist shocks you. That you can perceive in such a totally different way. The things which were always there are now no longer there. Changes the way you look at life. It's a sheer power which actually creates the insights. And that is their main purpose. Not just to have fun, because unfortunately the fun doesn't last. You can bliss out to the max for many days, but then you have to come back to earth. You have to go to work. You have to deal with politics in the office, or me with Sangha politics, deal with people who come and tell you about their marriage problems. And that's really sort of tough. You've just had a beautiful deep meditation and they start to talk about, oh, my husband is playing around and does this and does that. Oh, come on. You know, you've just been up in the highest heaven and now you're bringing me down to hell again. Well, that's life. So you can't stay in the high states forever, you have to come down again. But the great thing is that in those states, you've got this, again, like this gold seam of insights. It's as if the Dhamma is just right in front of you, just asking you, can't you see me? Can't you see me? Can't you see what's happening? Because what happens in those deep jhanas, again, doing the mentioning that these are vanishing acts. Things are disappearing. Your body's gone. Now, for those of you who think you know your body, you can't. You can't really understand the nature of your body, no more than a fish can understand the nature of water, because it's always there for you. Yeah, you can see a few of the things which change in your body, but its essential quality is always there, always in the background. You won't be able to understand. Which is one of the reasons why people, even though they meditate for many years, but they don't get into the jhanas. Even though that they can know so much about Dharma, they can even give brilliant Dharma talks. You think they can understand things, but then they get close to death. And they freak out, they get afraid. They haven't understood their body. Because it's always been there for them. And they haven't seen it. Anything which is always there, your brain can't see. The brain can only notice things which change. That's the way it's wired. The change is in the sound. The change is in the feelings. The change is in what you see. In one of those Zen monasteries I went to, there's a young Buddhist lay person. We had to face the wall with our eyes open. That's the way we meditated. I never understood why you do that, but you give anything a try. When you're young, you're very sort of courageous, inquisitive. Oh, let's give this a go, see what happens. So there you were, just facing the wall, sitting 50 minutes, doing nothing else except facing this blank wall. And weird stuff happened. The wall disappeared. It vanished. I thought, oh, this is really weird. This is good stuff. I told you I like weirdness. And it was only sort of a natural phenomena, because you were looking at a wall, you know, for a long time, and it wasn't changing. Because it didn't change, and it was not interesting, the sense of sight just turns off. It vanishes in the same way that your sense of hearing turns off. You know, if the air con is running and there's a constant buzz, after a while you just can't hear it. It just turns off. It's only, it's more weird for the sense of sight, because things change so much in your field of vision that you very rarely experience things disappearing. But if you sit in your room facing the wall and just look at a brick for 40-50 minutes, there's a good chance that might disappear. Weird. Where's it gone? Of course, it hasn't gone anywhere, just your sense of sight has turned off. It's only when things disappear you understand your nature of perception. And when your body disappears, you understand at last what this body is. And that's why for insight practice, it's not as if you get into these deep meditations and then decide, now I must do insight, now I must do vipassana. These things are just staring you in the face. Something's happened, something's disappeared, what the hell was that? And frankly, I can't see how anybody who's got a fantastic experience like that won't look back upon it and investigate it. It's your nature to do so. So get into these deep meditations. And what do you do? I was just so blissful. Why? Why was that the happiest experience, by far, by leaps and bounds, than anything I've ever experienced before? That's the question. And you've got this wonderful framework for the Buddha's teachings. Because something which was suffering has disappeared. What's disappeared? My body. My body is gone. And that is the cause of the happiness of the first jhana. At last, this heavy, dull, irritating body has disappeared. Oh, what bliss. You know, the other time you'll have that experience, even if you don't get into jhanas, is when you die. I like collecting people's near-death experiences. You know, they're great evidence, you know, which supports, you know, jhana practice. In near-death experience, what happens? Five senses stop, you see the light, you go to the light. And if you get this sort of the similarities there, five senses stop when you die, you see the light, you go to the light, and you go into these bliss states, pure love, sometimes people say. You're sitting here, your five senses go, you're meditating, you see this beautiful light, and then you're blissed out. Jhanas. It's exactly the same light. What you'll see when you die is what you call the nimitta when you're meditating, and only really gets strong when your five senses are vanished. So I like these near-death experiences, but if you actually read up on the near-death experiences, or you had one yourself, a common feature is that once you leave your body, oh, it's just so nice. The most pleasant and comfortable feeling you've ever had. And that's characteristic. And one of the most memorable anecdotes about someone who had a near-death experience who died on the operating table, and memorable because it has a very funny ending, was this woman who died during an operation, floated out of her body. Oh, just so wonderful, so peaceful. Went to this light, through the light, and met this guy at the other end and said, "It's not your time. You have to go back." And that's quite standard. But this time she says, "I don't want to go back. I'm having a lovely time." And this spirit being said, "But you have to go back." She said, "No way." I think she was Australian. And so they had this argument. Now that is actually weird, because I don't usually have arguments when you're in that sort of state. But in the end, she refused to go back into her body. And he insisted. And at the very last, he literally grabbed her and threw her into her body. And she lost all that beautiful peace and happiness and had this terrible feeling in the body again. And when she was interviewed, she said, "Now next time I die, when I go, into that world, I'm going to find that guy. I'm going to give it to him. What he made me do, I'll never forgive for that." She was really angry. But the reason she was angry, because it was showing that when you let go of your body, it's just beautiful. Having a great time. So just doing that, getting into, say, a first jhana experience, when you left your body, five senses which define your body have totally vanished, this disappeared, the idol disappearing. One of the insights you'll get from that is detachment from your body. You won't worry about it when it's about to die. You think, "Oh, whee, thank you so much. Soon I'm going to bliss out again. No more of this seeing and hearing business." And instead of celebrating the world of the five senses, you realize that when they disappear, it's the best of all. In our world, we celebrate seeing like a sunset over the Caribbean, seeing the Great Wall of China, seeing the birth of your first child, just feeling this amazing sex, listening to the Berlin Philharmonic playing Beethoven's Fifth. What are like the highlights of your life? If you've been at a first jhana, all that sucks. And sometimes people say, "You monks are really weird. You've got to get a life." And we say, "No, you've got to get a death." You've got to vanish, for goodness sake, to find out that all this stuff which you celebrate is actually pretty rotten stuff compared to what happens when all this disappears. So straight away that experience is giving you an insight which is going to change a lot of the way you look at life. The sorts of things which grabbed your attention, which motivated you, are not that meaningful anymore. But disappearance is more meaningful. And one of the things, your fear of death, one of the great things which motivates people to stop voluntary euthanasia, to get very scared about things like abortion and suicide, this underlying fear which just makes these moral decisions, not moral at all, but decisions made out of fear, keep people alive at all costs because we're so afraid of death because we don't understand it. Now you do understand it. You've experienced what death is like. And it's not that bad. I'm not sort of someone who celebrates death. I celebrate disappearance, vanishing, peace at last. And so these are insights which come just from the first jhana. If you get so detached from your body, yeah, you've got to have a body, you look after it, but it doesn't sort of grab all of your time like it used to. So be careful. Those of you meditating, if you do get into these jhanas, it's going to change the way you look at your life. Are you prepared for that? You might as well, because it's truth and it's happy, it's peaceful. So go for it. Simile was, this is the best simile which I've given. I can't repeat these similes, but they're pregnant with so much wisdom, so it's good to keep repeating them and looking at them and contemplating them as much as possible. And that's the simile of the tadpole. Tadpole who was born in water, and she grew up all her life in water. And she couldn't understand what water was. It was always around her. So she went to these lectures in the temple about water and dry land. And, you know, the frog who was giving these lectures was a very, very funny speaker. And, you know, Tall's talking about dry land, and it seemed to make so much sense. And sometimes, you know, the little tadpole thought she understood what dry land meant. But she didn't, because it was beyond her experience. She even went to Abhidharma classes on dry land, which explained the seven qualities of dry land. But still she couldn't understand dry land. Until one day, little tadpole grew some legs. Surprised her. She didn't strive to grow legs. She didn't say, I must grow legs, I must work hard to grow legs. They just grew by themselves. And because she had legs, she didn't know what she was doing, she hopped out of the water. She was on dry land. My goodness, this is weird. I've never experienced this before. This is totally different to everything I've ever known. Dry land. Just like you, you just grow these beautiful legs of letting go, and one day you jump out. There's no body anymore. You're in jhanas. This is weird. I didn't do this. I've never experienced anything like this before. And then, little new frog thinks, why is it weird? You know, it's something's missing. Something's missing which has always been there for me. Ah, that's what water is. That which has now disappeared. So when it goes back into the lake again, it now knows what water is. Because it had the experience where water has vanished. That's the only way you can know. In the same way, when you jumped into the jhanas, something's missing. My five senses and my body. Ah, that's what they are. That's why the definition of the first jhana, vivicheva kamehi vivicha akusalehi damehi, separated, aloof, standing apart from the five senses and the body, and separated from the five hindrances. That becomes the first jhana. No body anymore. No senses. Now you can understand what this body is, what the senses are. And just all that time you've been searching for happiness, for peace, for fulfillment in the seen, in the heard, in the smelt, in the tasted, in the physically felt. You understand just what a waste of time that all was. The very, very best which the five senses can give you is worth nothing compared to the bliss you have when they disappear. And that is not something you think out. That is not something you work out with your intellect. That becomes a bare experience, which is not there just for a flash, which is there for a long time. These jhanas last a long time. And they imprint themselves. You can't forget it. My goodness, that was really blissful. That was beautiful. And nothing in the world is like that, in the world of the five senses. The message has to get into your skull. But why am I attached to this body, this senses? You have to get detached. You've got the choice. Bliss or shitty stuff. What are you going to have? None of you will go to the toilet bowls for lunch. Then you go to the kitchen, it's more delicious stuff. That's what happens. So straight away your attachment just to the world of the five senses vanish. That's why that many of you will become monks and nuns if you get into these jhanas a lot. Why? Because like playing around with that stuff in the world? It just makes no sense. So it's not as if you have to choose. It's not as if you have to do anything. It's just automatic. Which brings me up onto that next great insight. You know, this something else disappears soon. Even on the first jhana, it's just almost 99% disappeared. There's a tiny bit left. But in the second jhana, and the third, and the fourth, that's totally gone. Which is your will. The chooser. The doer. The thing which you understood brought you to this retreat. The thing which made you scratch your nose. Did you do that? It always feels like we did it. Are you going to choose the food you're going to eat at lunch? It looks like you're doing that. I'm sorry, it's not you at all. It's a totally automatic process. You've been totally brainwashed, totally conditioned. None of you are really in control. That's the most scary thing. Because we always think that if somebody takes away our will and hypnotizes, that's the most evil thing in the world. As it is, it's already happened. You're totally conditioned. Which is why many of you are predictable. If you really had free will, you could not be predictable. You're predictable. I'm predictable. You know, I always tell silly jokes, and sometimes you know which joke's coming next. Sometimes you've heard it so many times before. I make no excuses for being predictable. But what happens in the second jhana? You're so absolutely still. There's never been a stillness like that before. In each of these states, sometimes you get into states of stillness, you think, this is it. You can't be more still than this. Then you get somewhere else and you are more still. This is just, your whole perceptual framework just takes a beating when you realize what you thought was the limit has got lots of places beyond it. It just goes deeper and deeper. More bliss than you could think ever could it be imagined, be experienced. More stillness, more peace, peace upon peace upon peace. You get to what you think is the summit, you can't go higher, and then you do. That's just the nature of this meditation process. It's brilliant, it's very amazing, beautiful. Have a wonderful time exploring just what's possible. But in the second jhanas and above, it's always noticed that there's something missing there. It's the reason why you just cannot move. What's missing there is your will. You can't move. You can't come out of the meditation. You can't think. You can't do anything. You're just there without the ability to choose or to will. Something which was always there for you. Yes, sometimes you can let go. Sometimes you cannot exercise your will. But it's always there for you in case you need it. Yes, sometimes you may not drive the car, but the steering wheel's always there. Imagine you're in your car and then the steering wheel suddenly disappears. Especially on the freeway, in the traffic. That's scary. I've got no steering. I can't do anything. I can't steer. I can't go left. I can't go right. I can't do anything. And that's actually what it's like. It's not scary. It's just weird and beautiful. And the reason why the bliss of the second jhana far exceeds the bliss of the first, because something else is missing. It's the will. And now you realize, just by checking the pleasure factor, the will is very painful. Because it's always been there for us, we don't realize just how an irritation it is, what a burden it is, how much dukkha, suffering, it is to have a will. You know the worst parts, when you have to make a choice, which way should I go? Should I do this, should I do that? You know, should I have the porridge, or should I have the cornflakes? Or should I have the muesli, or should I have the toast, or should I have the... That's just for breakfast. Imagine it is when I'm doing something important, like choosing a car, or choosing a career. Should I get divorced, or should I get married? All those sorts of choices. Look, if you're ever thinking of getting married again, don't just pick a coin and just whichever way it falls, just do it. Stop worrying. People just make such a difficult time making choices in the world. Because a lot of the time, I don't make any choices. It's just conditioning. It's just wonderful to know that. that the will doesn't belong to me. So I choose to go left, I choose to go right. I know I'm not choosing. So don't worry, no choice. Oh, what a great burden that is, off your chest. You don't have to worry about making decisions. Some of you just worry so much. Should I do this, should I do that? Sometimes you ring up the mic in the middle of the night, the dial a mic service. Look, I don't know whether I should change my job, or should I keep my job, because this is a better offer, but you know, I've got great friends in this one. Oh, just whatever you do is good enough. Because you are not in control. So in that second jhana, third jhana, number one, the extra bliss there, you soon find out is simply because all that will has disappeared. You find something you really attach to, something you cherish, the ability to choose, which is a pain, an irritation, something you better do without. And now you experience that. Now that is counterintuitive. That strikes at something which is very important to you because you don't want to give up your will, your choice. Yeah, when you get married, you don't want to give in. You get a job, you don't want to give in. You get to a religion like Buddhism, you want to argue. Why is that? Because you want to exert your will. You want to say, I'm still here, okay. Ajahn Brahm, yeah, what you say makes sense, but I'm going to argue just for the sake of it, just to show I'm still here. And sometimes that's interesting because that shows us how much we cherish our will. But when you get into these jhanas, you realize it's not yours and it disappears and it's weird. Now you can understand what attachments are. And you understand why you let go of them. You realize this thing will, which you now understand because you've gone to the place where it disappears. And you go back into that realm, you know that, yeah, you make choices. Yeah, you have the appearance of will, but it's not coming from you. It's just this empty process which is causing you a lot of trouble. You just have to endure it. But as soon as you can let go of it, you just let go and do nothing. Absolutely nothing. You don't do things. You're just there, peaceful, letting go, still. Which is why that I keep teaching like this. It's really fun not to do things. Let things be. Sit there and be still. So, when you can do things like that, you're getting great insights. Insight into the nature of will and why that will is not you. Okay, so what else, other insights have you got? What's left now? The knower. Your consciousness. The thing which is listening to me or looking at me right now. What is that? Now I'm not saying who is looking at me or listening to me, because that presupposes that there's something there. I say what is listening to me? What is knowing what I said? Now here we get to the heart of the sense, or rather the delusion of the self. Who you assume you are. And when you look at that in these meditations, it starts to vanish as well. Even that which knows starts to peel away like an onion and disappear stage by stage. That's what the other jhanas are there for. As you are a bystander watching your consciousness vanish and disappear. And just like when the will disappears, you know that that was not me. As your consciousness vanishes, you know that wasn't me either. And the more it vanishes, the more blissed out you get. And then you realize the insight, obvious, to know is to suffer. Even knowing is a pain, an irritation, an affliction, the Buddha said. Now, I hope you don't agree with me. Because if you do agree with me, then you're just making it up, you're pretending. Because you can't agree with me, I'm challenging your very existence. But what I'm saying is, this is what's going to happen to you. I'm giving you a menu, not the food. Don't be like the professor, rate the menu. This is actually showing you what to order and what's going to happen in these deep meditations, and your world is going to be turned upside down. What you thought was you, gee, it wasn't. And it'd be like somebody who realizes just how stupid I've been all these years. The Buddha said that, but saying that is not good enough. Teaching that is not good enough. You have to experience it for yourself. You have to. There's no other way. So get into the jhanas. Bliss out. See things vanish. And all the insights, the enlightenment insights, they just come to you. They change you. You're a different person. No longer attached to the body. No longer attached to the will. No longer attached even to your consciousness, because you realize there's nothing there at all. Empty. Gone. Now you understand what enlightenment is. And it means that, yeah, you live your life, but when you die, there's nothing left to want. So when you die, you're still. In other words, that first wanting, which will create your next life, never arises. Remember, to get reborn, somebody asked me that question. Now, if I want to be reborn, sort of, you know, with the woman I love, I want to get reborn with her again, what should I do? You have to make the good karma, in other words, to get the spiritual resources, and then you have to want to get reborn in that realm with her. It's not just the karma, it's the wanting. Why do you get reborn in this life? Because you wanted to. So if you let go of all wanting, at your death there's nothing to move you. You stay there in stillness and you slowly vanish. Vanish, vanish, until you're gone forever. That's the end of samsara. But just one little blip, I want, you get reborn again. And you have to go through it all over again. Just how much trouble it was even just getting this far in your life. How many divorces have you gone through, breakups, kids driving you crazy? How many times at school did you get into trouble? How many times have you sort of got into sort of trouble with the police or the authorities? How many times you got sick? How many times you had diarrhea and just wet your pants and just all this other stuff? Do you really, really want to do that all over again? If you do, get out of here. But if you really want to sort of make an end of things, this is what happens. And don't worry, it's blissful. Blissful, blissful, blissful all the way. A very happy path. So this is what the jhanas are. This is what the insight is. This is how it all happens. So I say this, realizing, yeah, you could frighten some people, but you are too far gone. So I'm sorry, friends, but you're on the bus, and it's not stopping for anybody. Next destination, Nirvana. So it's a bit late now. You shouldn't have come in the first place. So that's the talk this morning about jhanas and insight, enlightenment and everything. Bye-bye, everybody. Okay. So that's a talk. Any quick questions about what I've just been saying? Or are we going to write them down on a piece of paper for tonight? No, going, going, going. Okay, so now we have the interviews. One quick question, okay. If it's in the first jhana, you can't. But what happens is a sound can happen, and you can hear that, but basically you're out of the first jhana, and you go back in again. It's just like you're in the room, and someone knocks on the door, you just put your head outside to see who it is. But you haven't really left the room, but you have left the room. So that's what it is. So that's what they say, the Buddha actually said, that the sound can penetrate the jhana, but it just penetrates, but actually brings you out. So really, within the jhana, if it's a real jhana, you don't hear anything. And that's only if the jhana hasn't really sort of solidified. If it solidifies, you can't hear anything. I may give this image, like some of, there's lots of Sri Lankans here. Some of your husbands are watching the cricket. You know, Sri Lanka versus Australia. And it's getting down to the last over, and it's really, you know, sort of tense, and you don't know who's going to win. And you tell your husband, darling, you know, the dinner's ready. He doesn't ignore you. He just can't hear you. So it's similar to jhana because, you know, the sense of sound is turned off. Especially for the wife. Could you get so absorbed into it? This is just Ramsan and Jhana just having such a wonderful time. You just can't hear. So anyway. Okay, so let's do the interviews now.